Okay, so question? No old bard.
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah.
I love the spirituality that you were presenting this morning, and in particular the sense that God is in each and every one of us. What I'm trying to wrestle with is how, maybe in the Hindu tradition, you get from individual to group.
Mm.
You know what I mean? There's this issue, there's this thing that we've been developing in the Christian tradition, which is a sense of community, that we can't do much by ourselves, but when we get together, you know, we can't even do our energy unless there's a group of us. So this idea of the necessity of group action and group cohesion and group awareness is kind of forced on us in the Christian tradition. Do you have anything similar in...
There are monastic communities in India. We don't have the idea of obedience so much, because in order in the Hindu tradition to be a Hindu monastic, you've got to be a pretty independent guy.
I'm not talking about monks. I'm talking about...
Right.
Yeah.
In the Hindu tradition, the Western culture is a very sort of egotistical culture. There's a lot of emphasis on individuality. And we're always afraid that we're going to lose our individuality. But a lot of times that individuality consists of holding to our ignorance as hard as we can, saying, well, I'm an alcoholic and that's who I am. I have to have my 3 drinks a night and that's who I am. Or I have to go gambling because that's who I am. Or I like this kind of thing and that's who I am. Or I like to make music at night and the hell with you because that's who I am. So we sort of identify with our selfishness and like what my desires are, and by damn, this is what I want, and so the group is going to have to adjust to me. So I think in the Indian tradition, there's a lot of emphasis on family and community. In the Indian tradition, in many of the Eastern cultures, you'll see great emphasis on family and community. That when... You'll notice that Indian students and Chinese students do really well in school. Why is that? Because it reflects on your family. If you do something bad, it's not your individual shame, it's the whole family shame. It reflects not only the family, but the family in the community, because in most of India is still quite rural. There's a lot of people in the cities, but it's quite rural. So everybody knows everything. And everyone has a job. It's like there's a lot of discussion about the caste system, but when the caste system was originally formed, first of all, it wasn't set in stone. It was like these tendencies lead you to live in a certain group of people. If you have a tendency to be a thinker or to be able to recite a lot, you would be a Brahmin. The people who recite the scriptures, and the Brahmins were revered, because the scriptures were not written down until Max Müller came there in the 1890s and had the scriptures taken down. They were not written. Scriptures were considered so sacred they could only be orally recited. So the Brahmins were greatly revered because they were the maintainers of the scriptures and the culture. Everything was orally recited. So those people who had the memory to recite. In fact, in Yugoslavia, even like 60 years ago, they found bards who could recite an epic for 2 weeks without interruption, all locked in their memory. So these Brahmins were revered for having the knowledge of the scriptures. So that was their job. The Kshatriyas, the people who were the men who were active and dynamic and could be forceful, were the upholders. They were the kings. Because if you like to memorize, you're not fit to be a king. You're a soldier. You're a soldier, and you'll protect the community. Other people are good at being merchants. That's their job. Other people are good at labor. They're really good with planting things and doing things. And some people are really good at other things. So these people are, everything sort of fits. It meant that in the ideal situation, it's like everyone is great in his own place. It doesn't mean you're spiritually greater than anyone else. The greatest, the Sri Krishna, for example, was not a Brahmin. He was a kshatriya. He was a warrior. Rama, the incarnation of God, the embodiment of dharma, the embodiment of righteousness, was a warrior. These guys were the reciters of scriptures. These were people on the battlefield. The Bhagavad Gita occurs on the battlefield. And it's how to do action. The kingdom was being taken over by force. The people who were unrighteous were taking over the kingdom. They said, we just want the, in this war, the people said, we just want one small village where we can live. And they had taken away this kingdom. And they had molested one of the women, and they'd done these terrible things. And they said, we will not allow you to be here, even to have the land on the head of a pin. So, because they were forced into it, they had to fight. So this whole Bhagavad Gita, this sacred scripture, occurs on the battlefield. Because we're all a battlefield. We're all a battlefield. We are facing battles every day of our lives. We're battling our own minds. We're battling our own instincts. We're having trials every day. How do we deal with it? So this is a long thing, but this is how the caste system started up. And it began with an invasion. So with an invasion, how do you keep your society working? Later, as time went on, it became sort of codified, but in the West, you have this idea where people go, where people don't sort of change jobs, and that's really inaccurate. In the cities, no one has any idea what any of this caste is. It isn't like you can tell. I can tell if I hear the person's last name and they live in Bengal, I can kind of figure out what their caste is. But, I mean, in other places, people are from lower caste are given preference. So, for example, in Kerala, if you're among the lower caste, you have a good chance of getting into college. And if you're an upper caste, you might have a really hard time. Just because there's been so many years of inequity, they're trying to balance it. And so, of course, it takes a long time for these things to work out. One of my closest friends is Swami. He's a Swami in this country from India. His family is Brahmin. They're all goldsmiths. Now, a goldsmith should be a merchant. But, you know, it doesn't work that way. I have a question back here.
Relating to what Tom is asking, is there communal ceremonies?
Yes. There are things like, there's very little what we call communal prayer, where you would get together and say, I believe that. Because you're never going to find a Hindu saying, I believe in anything, because everyone disagrees, because it's a very chaotic, wonderful... If there's two Hindus that agree with each other, it must be a genetic anomaly. Two Hindus, three battles. But, so, we don't have... There's no one scripture. There's many sacred scriptures. There's no one dogma. There is no central authority. Thank God. So, everyone kind of... There are a number of scriptures that people revere. There is things like where people get together and have what we call kirtan or bhajan. Well, everyone will get together and sing. Everyone will get together. Or there'll be a special holy day or a puja celebration where everyone will go to the temple. But they're not sitting down in the temple. They go in. There's a wonderful word called darshan, where that means you'll go into the temple and the form of God that's there sees you. That's what's important, is God seeing you. Hi, I saw you. Okay, you saw me. Good. Out of here. They don't meditate in the temple. The temples are chaotic there. So there's very little sort of organized thing. You know, organization really came with the Romans. And if you find Hindus being organized, they could use a little more of it. So we don't have the sort of thing to have any sort of an organization. You need to have a number of people being unselfish enough to see the value of the whole and to get their own ideas down. So you need to have, like in any family, for things to work. You can't have one person, I want this, I want that, I want that, I want that. You have to have at least someone there who's going to say, I'm going to take the back seat, and your needs come first, your needs, and your needs, instead of everyone's needs coming first. Alice, your hand is up.
Fundamentalism in Hinduism, or there is...
Oh, there's plenty of fundamentalism, and they're all different. It's like, you'll hear about Hindu fundamentalists, and they'll all believe something different. I mean, you'll have people who are like, well, there was a great social upheaval with the Muslim invasion. And there's been a lot of problems with the Muslim invasion even since that, because they went into the temples and desecrated the temples. And things, people got along really fairly well until the British came in. And when the British came in, they were very good about setting one group against the other. And so they go over to the Muslims, they said, you know what the Hindus did? The Hindus have put pork in their stuff. And they go to the Hindus, they say, you know what? The Hindus, the Muslims are over there killing your cows. And so they start this sort of thing. And so, you know, these people, they raped all your women. And so they were very clever at setting these things up. And so it was in Lucknow, for example, there was never any. Lucknow is one of the largest cities of India. It's up in the north and has the largest mix of Hindus and Muslims living together. They've never had a problem. And in fact, when there was a Hindu mob that came from somewhere else, typically, that went up there to try to tear down a mosque, all the Hindus got together, held hands, protected it. Does that ever get into the Western news? Of course not. Of course not. Most people in India get along just fine. But there are groups, and it's because of the politicians getting in there, they've created what they call vote banks. It's like, the Muslims get this percentage of the vote, they get this percentage of the political party, and it sets people off against each other. But, yeah.
Why were the British interested in having a divisive...
Because divide and conquer. That's how they ruled India until 1947. It worked very well. Bengal was the largest state in India. It was the intelligentsia of India. It was both the cultural and political capital. They divided Bengal into three states, into Orissa, West Bengal, East Bengal, which later went to Pakistan, became Bangladesh, and Bihar. And then they changed the capital to Delhi. It was how they conquered the country. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you have a temple.
Yes.
And what is the purpose of the temple?
The purpose of the temple.
And the other part is, do you have a Vedanta ceremony or something where people gather?
Yes.
So what is that? How does that fit in?
Let me say that the Vedanta Society is the Western branch of the Ramakrishna Order of India. And Ramakrishna was the 19th century sage who preached the unity of all religions. It was his disciple Swami Vivekananda who brought Hinduism to this country in 1893. So, as with many other Eastern religions and came, this was America's first real introduction to Hindu thought, even though we had some with Thoreau and Emerson and a few of the transcendentalists. So wherever he came, people were interested. And so in many places where he spoke, Vedanta Society started. He was not particularly interested in starting Hindu societies. He felt that for people to, the goal of life is to realize God. It doesn't matter what culture you're in, it doesn't matter what religion you belong to. He said the point of Vedanta is to make a Christian a better Christian, a Hindu a better Hindu, you know, a Jew a better Jew. This is the point. We're not here to convert everybody because we believe that every religion is true. The Rig Veda, which was probably 4,000 BC, said truth is one. Sages call it by various names. 4,000 BC. So that, which is why our bookstore has books from every religious tradition. We have books, the three rabbis in town said we have the best Jewish bookstore in town. We have a great section on Islam. We have the only Spanish language Quran you can buy in the city. Many books in the Quran. Mother Mary Claire said her Claire said we're the best Catholic bookstore in town. We have books on Zoroastrianism, on Sikhism, on Hawaiian religion, Native American religion, you name it, we do it. Because we believe that's our calling. Everybody has a spiritual path and everybody will attain God. Everyone will realize their divine nature by following their own natural spiritual path. What we don't believe is don't try to change anybody from their path. Encourage them to go further. God is infinite. God, how can we know that infinite divine being? So move further on that path. So as part of the Vedanta Society, we're part of the Ramakrishna Order in India. In India, we're one of the largest social service organizations in the country. We've received many. We've received the Indira Gandhi Award, the Mahatma Gandhi Award, which gives us like 1 million rupees for us to do our social work. We do work with, when the tsunami, we were there. With working with the untouchable community and trying to get them literate, we're there. We build latrines for villages that have no toilet systems. We do everything from pre-child education to adult education. We have hospitals. We have schools. We, you know, any type of relief, we're there. So because we believe if you want to serve God, serve human beings standing in front of you. Part of that, so that's what we call the Ramakrishna Mission, which is nothing but social work, or social service, I should say, which is part of our monastic organization. And they give a lot of, the government gives us money, and a lot of people give us money for that. Because everything that we do is complete, the monastic organizations take not a penny from that. We have a big billboard at our headquarters with like, it's actually a chalkboard like that. We write down, 1 million rupees went to this, 1,000 rupees went to this, 4,000 blankets were given here, 200 food packets were given here. The other part is the Ramakrishna Mission or the contemplative side. Because in our order, we have both. The motto of our order is, service is realization of God for oneself and service to God in humanity. They're like two wings of the bird. Service on one side and contemplation on the other. In this country, most of our service is spiritual service. We also do things like transition house and stuff like that, and but most of the poverty we see here is spiritual. And that's where we feel that we can do the best of our work. We do come in where we're called, but I mean, there's organizations in this country which are much more organized and have much more money than we do to do that type of work. We do have Sunday services, which is what we do is our adjustment to the West. And because in India, there is no such thing as a Sunday service. They have every day to them is a special day. There's no sort of, in the Hindu tradition, there's no sort of separation between a holy day and an unholy day. There's no sort of separation between what is sacred and what is secular. It's all holy. God pervades everything. It's like some things, we want to make our life as close to divinity as possible, so what we try to do is divinize everything that we do, and that they call karma yoga, or the yoga of action, the way of uniting. Yoga means union with God. So how do we have union with God? Well, one type is like what they call the union of God through love, by loving God, by thinking of God. Another way is karma yoga, by having all our actions being of service to God. So we can sweep a path. We can do weeding, and we can do that for God. God, I know that you walk here in your many forms. I'm weeding this path for you to walk here. We can cook a nice meal for our family, knowing that I'm serving God that way. Because every one of those people who come and eat, I'm serving God that way. So this is part of what we do. But Sunday, we have an 11 o'clock lecture. We have a worship service that's done every day, which is what is called puja, or a ritualistic worship that's done. It's a way of worshiping God, and also it's a meditation and worship that's done. And then we also have Vespers that's done every evening. At 6 o'clock every evening we have Vespers, or what they call in Sanskrit, arati, where all the elements that comprise the universe are offered to God at the end of the day. At the end of the day, when things are getting kind of quiet and dark and kind of the universe folds into itself, the five elements that comprise the universe are offered to God. So the first thing that we do is we have these little butter lamps, and those are lit, and they make this little lamp of fire. So you offer the fire for all the fire in the universe. The sun is fire. All the stars are fire. All the fires on the earth, the burnings that we see here, when we turn on the gas stove, that's an element of fire. So that is offered. And then after that, we have a conch shell with water in it that we pour out for all the water in the universe, all the oceans, all the rivers, all the streams. After that, we offer a handkerchief. We wave a handkerchief for all the air that we breathe. Then we offer a flower for all the earth, not only all our little earth, but all the planets that we know and don't know, all the earth there, that God is the manifestation of God and we offer to God at the end of the day. And then we have a yak tail fan, which is a large, beautiful fan that we wave to represent all the space. Mm-hmm. All the space of the universe that comprises everything outside of our understanding that we offer to God at the end of the day along with our own actions. Whatever we have done, said, or thought. All this we offer to God, good and bad. Oh Lord, I make this an offering to you. That we do at the end of the day, every day at 6 o'clock. So those are sort of the things that we do every day. Apart from our regular meditation time, which is in the morning between like 6:30 and 7, 7:30 depending on the person. But we have the temples open every day between 6:30 and 7 at night. So we have regular things. And then we have the bookstore open. We have a lot of things that happen.
So it is communal prayer.
Yes, it is. Not necessarily, because we're all, people might be sitting, but you don't know what they're doing. Because every person is meditating on God in his or her own way. Oh yeah, well people are watching that, yes. And the nuns upstairs are singing vesper songs. So that's a communal thing. Ha, one communal thing. And after there's music. Yes, Maria.
What is the location of a temple in Santa Barbara?
It's on Ladera Lane off of East Valley Road. About two thirds the way up the hill on the left. It has a big rock outside that says Vedanta Temple.
And
the rocks.
Yeah.
That's where the bookstore is. Yes.
Kay Hart had a quote that said, "Union differentiates." And when I listen to you talk, mm-hmm. I'm more Catholic. I feel more Catholic. But you're speaking from the center of the Hindu tradition.
Yes.
So I don't feel less Catholic when I listen to you, and that's where I think truth is one.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the beauty of the heart, of the mystical heart of all of the religious traditions. We become more ourselves
indeed
when we are in union with others.
And we can also have such love for our tradition and learn much more about our own tradition when we learn from others too. It doesn't mean like a cafeteria religion where you take, you know, do this and do that and do that and do that. It's like they say in the Hindu tradition to love every religion, but dig your own deep well.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to dig a little well here and a little well here and a little, you'll never find water that way. So dive deeper and deeper and deeper into your own water to get that clear spring, refreshing water from our own tradition. Because we're all brought here for a reason. We're all brought here together. We all have our little, that's why you don't find communal prayer too much in the Hindu tradition, because everybody has a different idea of God. We've all come into this world in a different way. No suit fits the same person. And we all have kind of a spiritual suit, our own individual way of thinking and meditating about God.
Matthew Fox was here a couple years ago at the Mind and Supermind, and he had just written a book called, One River, Many Wells.
Yes. Yeah, we did have it in our bookstore, unless we sold it by now.
That's what it was about.
Yeah, he's a great person.
Well, it was a religious practice.
Thomas Merton was a monk and was restricted in his activities, although as a monk
he got around him pretty well.
He was the most famous mystic Catholic writer in the 20th century. And the abbot would not let him leave to do dialogue with Hindus and Buddhists. And finally in 1968 he left the monastery and went to India and so on, and he died in Thailand. I can't even imagine what would have happened if he had lived in terms of his writings and his influence on the Catholic.
I sort of feel like he knew what he was supposed to do. He opened the door for so many. I love the Asian Journal. I love the Asian Journal, what came out of his trip. And his thing on monasticism, one of the appendices, is one of the most beautiful things I've ever read about monasticism. So one of the Swamis I was the closest to in my life, a man who was like a spiritual father to me, was the Swami, that Swami Lokeshananda, who you can find in the Asian Journal, and who wept and wept when he found out that the Merton had been electrocuted. Because he said, the spirituality and the tension, he said, I felt like I found my own brother. He said, we talked all night. And just to find another monk like that, so open-hearted and ready for this heart-expanding dialogue, seems true. In His Holiness the Dalai Lama, love. Just loved him. But I think that's what he was born on earth to do. He did it, and then he checked out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's glory in that too. It's like the Swami Vivekananda died at the age of 39. And he knew he had his opportunity to choose when he would die. And he said, if there's one large tree, the other smaller trees can't grow up.
Mm-hmm.
So he allowed so many others. Martin would have taken over the whole forest. I would have totally driven his ass to distraction. Yes.
I have a question from kind of a different angle. We have a concept of God in the Western tradition that says God works with intention. So some might say that the tsunami is an act of God for a certain reason. Or
I sort of have a hard time dealing with that.
Yeah, so what...
Because, I mean, then we get into the problem of good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, and that's, you know, from the time I was 7 until I discovered Vedanta when I was 15. That was like, how can God allow the Holocaust?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was just, how do you say 7 million Jews, 6 million Jews, how many Jehovah's Witnesses, how many gay people? I mean, I was just like, and I had friends who, I had a girlfriend when I was in 6th grade who died a very long and difficult death of cancer. It's like, how could God allow that?
Mm-hmm.
So then you get into the problem of good and evil. Does God allow evil? Or does he not care?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, either way, you've got a problem. Which is why it sort of came to the idea of karma. It's like, karma means that we do actions that will have a reaction. Karma simply comes from the verb root, kri, which means to do. So karma is action, and it's the effect of action. So it means, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. So every action, every thought that we do brings a reaction to it. You throw something into the pond, and you will get these waves that come back out of it, those ever-widening circles. Maybe not in this life, but in a previous life. That was the only thing I could wrap my mind around. Does that mean? It means that God can affect our own karma, but sometimes it's in our own best interest to have these things happen. I met this wonderful Catholic woman who came to the temple maybe 10 years ago. And what happened to her brought her back to her Catholic tradition. She had been sexually abused by her stepfather and traumatized, and somehow she had barely managed to recover from that. When she found out that the very man who had abused and traumatized her had gone after her son.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when she decided she had to talk to her husband about it, confided to her husband that she too had been abused, and that's when he said he had also been abused.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, I said, how do you get through the day? And she said, no, this has given me so much strength. This has given me so much strength. I have overcome it, and I can help others to overcome this as well. I will not define myself by this happening to me. She got strength from that, and she was able to start programs for other young women where this had happened to them, so they could see something beyond their sexual abuse. And I think when we see a tragedy like what we see now in the tsunami, it's like we see one sort of freeze frame of a very long movie. We don't know what's come before, and we don't know what's come afterwards. Often it's the most painful things that happen to us that sort of allow us to grow into something that we wouldn't have grown otherwise. This will go. It will go at some time. We don't know what the next step will be. It's like, do you want to die for 5 minutes in a tsunami, maybe 3 minutes? Or do you want to die a long, lingering death of cancer? Do you want to die being drowned? Or do you want to have like 10 years of Alzheimer's? We're all going to go. We're all going to go.
Mm-hmm.
We can't blame God. It's like, we all have our part. Do we ask God? St. Teresa of Avila said we have to watch out for our answered prayers.
Mm-hmm.
That can be God knows how things should be, but it's also our karma, how we fight into it. In some sense, in the Hindu tradition, we believe that we are born where we can grow the most, because the goal of human life, no matter where we are, is to realize that divinity within us. So we will be born into a place where we can manifest our gifts the most, where that which we need to work out in our life will be worked out, where we can learn the lessons where we need to learn and grow in the way that we need to grow. And often that is through pain. And often it's us making a sacrifice. But that is how we grow. Rather than God being the eternal policeman, or God being the eternal like, so what you doing? I'm going to have a flash flood, and by the way, you're all damned. How can we love someone like that? Yes, Jim.
God is love, and that love does not include blame.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It doesn't include blame, and God is at that deepest part of us. And in a sense, we just have to relax and trust what's being done to us. If we see others going towards pain, do whatever we can to avert the kind of pain that they're going to experience, and see if there's anything humanly possible that we can do to mitigate that pain. But within our own thing, rather than God having been the eternal fall guy. Yeah.
So, am I hearing you say to suspend coming to conclusions about what has happened with Japan and allow the unfolding of a larger picture?
Yes, because we only can do what we can. I hope to God they can do something about the nuclear scene so that we won't have more loss of life. Mm-hmm. I think we should all need to pray. I think we all need to pray. And to hope that the catastrophe can stop where it can stop. Mm-hmm. But as far as that, you know, prayer, wherever we can send help, send that. But we don't know the larger picture. Do I think it's for the world's good? I don't know what's good for the world. I don't know. I don't know if this is going to mean to be, you know, a nuclear halt. How could that possibly be good? It's in God's. God is both the creator and the destroyer. In the Hindu tradition, you don't have a devil. You have God having eternally, the West tends to think in terms of linear time.
Mm-hmm.
We start here and we end here. Every Eastern tradition will think, whether it's India or China or Japan, the Taoist tradition, the Hindu tradition, the Buddhist tradition, will all think in terms of a circle. Everything starts and everything kind of, like human life. You know, we start out as a baby, mm-hmm. and at the end, if we live long enough, we become weak and helpless like a baby. And that's the way it is. Everything has a circle of life. The tree is small, it grows up, it dies, the pods fall down, they start again. It's this wonderful circle. And they often show Shiva with his cosmic dance. He's dancing this wonderful dance, he's stepping on a demon. And while he's dancing, the universe goes on. And when he stops, the universe closes in on itself, and we go into a little black hole. It's like creation stops, and then it starts again. We're such a tiny speck in the universe. How can we possibly understand the big picture?
Mm-hmm.
All we have to know is that the love in our hearts is the one with the love of God. And that God is the deepest portion of ourselves, and we just have to trust in that. Do what we can with our limited understanding, which is about this big, and then hope that we can kind of put ourselves in the right place, getting the ego out of the way, in the right place that we can kind of move forward and do things in a compassionate and loving way.